teacher, Sister Agnes Joseph. Remember, they taught us Latin and history. And in my senior year, Sister Ambrose was my principal, and Sister Florence was also there. Sister Geraldine and I, who was Beatrice Landers, we had decided in our senior year that we wanted to enter the community, become sisters, and it was really a big sacrifice in my family, because that was 1923, and it seems that economic conditions weren't just altogether too good then. Exactly. So that whatever work I did in my senior year on Saturdays, my mother told me to put that money aside, you know, towards my the clothing or whatever I needed. And also, I had an aunt who was not married, and she was my mother's sister, my aunt Maggie. I had a name for her. And she helped me a lot. She, you know, just provided me with everything that I would need if I had my own little weekly money, didn't take care of it. And it seemed that Sister Florence was afraid that Sister Geraldine and I, instead of entering, I think she told Mother Alphonse or something about us. So instead of letting us wait until September 8th, Mother Alphonse, who was newly elected the Mother Superior in June of 1923. Mother Bonaventure had been the Mother Superior. And during that year also, in December of 1922, Sister Daria, that was Helen Landers, who was still in her sophomore year at high school, but wanted to enter, they took her December 8th of 1922. Well, then they advised us to wait and finish our senior year, see. So we were graduated, Sister Geraldine and I, with the rest of the class, on them, which included my brother, Ed. And the idea there, why he caught up to me, was, first of all, I had repeated my freshman year, and he and a couple others skipped the eighth grade. You know, as I said, they were trying to build this class up, see. So they took about three, I think, seventh graders, and they skipped the eighth grade and put them in high school.
So that was a boys and girls high school?
Yes, yes, boys and girls. So Sister Geraldine and I then were graduated on June 17th, 1923, and Mother had us enter on July 2nd. And I heard it was whispered that she was afraid that those two, that was Sister Geraldine and myself, would get jobs, good jobs, and maybe not enter, see. So she settled us by bringing us in July 2nd, 1923.
Do you think that was Sister Florence's idea that you might get
jobs? I don't know. I suppose she told them. I'm not sure. Probably her idea, because Mother Bonaventure, you know, I had been down to see her a couple of times, but I'm sure she didn't look that situation over, you know, herself, Mother Alphonse's either. So I think it was Sister Florence's notion. She knew. She used to stop in our house when she'd be out walking, you know. So I think they just knew that they better get me in and get Sister Geraldine in, too. Now, there was a nice part about Sister Geraldine that I want to tell you about. We started to school together in the third grade at Point Name School. Now, the reason the third grade, what happened in the first and second? Well, we didn't have Point Name School in the first and second grade. While we were in the first and second grade, we were in the third grade when the school opened. So I told you, Duquesne was in three wards. And Sister Geraldine lived in the third ward. And so did we, because we were just, but we were not on the other side of Fifth Street Bridge. but our house, Priscilla Avenue, was just divided that way. And I was always small and a little bit fragile or delicate or something, you know, cough around the place and so on. So they didn't want me to cross the bridge and go to school up the third ward. So I stayed with my grandmother, who was just about a block or two away from the public school in the second ward. Stayed with her from Monday till Friday, and then I could go to the second ward school. All right. I didn't like staying with my grandmother too well because she was English, and I don't know whether it was because she was English or what, but she washed my face without a washcloth. I got the washcloth for a bath, but when she washed my face in the morning, she had large, it seemed to me, slimy, I would say slippery hand, you know, and she'd soap it up and then wash me with her hand. And I just hated the feeling of her hand going over my face. I still remember it, you know, and it just seems unusual that I would, but I could still feel her hand. Then I go home on Friday and stay until time to go back to school on Monday. Third grade then, we all went to Holy Name School. I took care of that. My brother started in the first grade, and I started in the third grade. And we had a number of sisters that year teaching us, and I can understand now why. I think that they were young sisters, novices probably. Like I had Mother Benigna, Sister Anita, and Sister Brandon. And they were probably not allowed to break their canonical year, say. So they just teach so long, you know.
Oh, I see. You had one after the other.
Yes, all in the third grade. Well, Sister Geraldine and I were together. So we went through grade school and high school together, and for some reason or other, the Mother Superior sent Sister Geraldine and me. First of all, she sent us to Duquesne University, and they didn't send all juniors at that time, but she sent us, along with the Star Sisters and Mary Magdalene and a couple others. And she also sent us to Marywood College in Scranton when we were just professed in January. We started there in June. And that, again, was, you know, not a common thing. Novices, or junior, I mean, away from my titles, young professed were not sent away to school, but we weren't. So we went all through college work and, you know, continued at Duquesne University during the year and so on. And we went 5 years to Marywood College in Scranton and we graduated. So that took care of that. Let's see where I want to go. I graduated and I entered the community. All right. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Duquesne's playgrounds and the fun we had. We had two playgrounds. One was down on 2nd Street between Grant Avenue and Kennedy Avenue. And the other one was below the railroad. And below the railroad was kind of the pits, as far as we were concerned. You were afraid to cross the railroad, for one thing. And then when you crossed the railroad, you were just like right in the mill gates. So that was kind of a no-no. You didn't go below the railroad too often. Although there was a section with people living there who were, you know, quite prosperous, middle income. They weren't just poor people. Anyhow, we didn't go below the railroad.
Do you think they were different nationality?
Yeah, a lot of them were. Of the poor people, they were. But the playgrounds were all well equipped. We had all kinds of crafts. And we went there all summer long. And I can remember that we learned to make baskets, weave baskets, and do work with raffia. Which, you know, I guess I've seen your raffia here over in that basket there, that plant. That's a raffia basket. We did all kinds of work like that, and we had all kinds of games. We had very good dancing teacher there for a couple of years, and then he came back in the winter time, and if you could afford it, you could take lessons from him, and I did 1 year that he was there. We had the swimming, this didn't have anything to do with it, but we had a very good library, a Carnegie Library, and it was on there were terraces from the library down to 2nd Street. Get away from our playground top, though. I'll come back to that. We had good, we had movies there every week, and we take little chairs with us, you know, like children's chairs or stools, and you just pick up your chair and take it with you that evening, go down to the playground and sit there and watch the movie for free.
Who provided the movies and equipped the playgrounds?
I guess the town. I don't know. We didn't pay anything, so I suppose the town did. We had the Keystone Cops, all that kind of stuff, you know, it was really funny. Mud pie slinging, you know, comedy, all that nonsense. But it was a lot of fun. I know I got into trouble, I was put off the playground a few times. Eileen, you know, my militant Catholic friend, well, we get into fights with girls who weren't Catholic, you know, and they'd say something about the Catholics, so we'd up and knock their sand castles over or throw sand on them and then get put off the library or off the playground. The library was very good, very extensive, and they had a good natatorium there. You could go there and swim. Your ticket for the, I think it was for how many months, I don't think it was for the whole year, it was 50 cents. And you had was 1 or 2 days a week to swim. And it gave you a little locker room to keep your suit, you know, in, and towel, and so on. You didn't leave it there, but you could, you know, get undressed and go in. It was very, very good. And as I said, the library was excellent. It's all been torn down just lately in kind of a low-income housing project. I think it's low income, I'm not sure. I was told that some of it was low income. But, you know, that's no, the houses look very nice, and they're well kept, and the grounds around them. But we've always felt bad about losing that library. I think I heard the story that it was in such disrepair, and it would cost too much. The city didn't have enough money to put into it, and therefore, they just, you know, demolished it. And what happened to the books?
There's no library in Decatur now.
No, there's no library there at all. Mm-hmm. And that is really, to my mind, it was really tragic because of what use we made of it. Now, the playgrounds were, as I said, were just excellent. We had a lot of work that they taught us how to do. And the library terraced, as I told you, you know. I can remember the part of that was that on the 4th of July, everybody in town went down to the library for the whole day. Your mother made potato salad and some kind of meat sandwiches, ground ham or something, and watermelon and so on. You just packed your picnic lunch. Although we lived just about a block and a half from the library, we still would pack up and go down and sit on the terrace. And down on 2nd Street, there would be parades and games and, you know, put on all. And then across the Monongahela River, that's why I don't want you to think that's Braddock, see, because it isn't, it's just a hill. Across there in the evening, they had really the most magnificent fireworks I have ever seen. Anytime everybody runs now to watch fireworks, you know, I think of ours. And ours were just so magnificent, so much better than what, you know, they have now. And everybody would sit there all evening long and watch the fireworks and go home, whole families. But everybody celebrated together, you know, in that small town. That was the part that I, you know, really loved, just that all. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody went down and celebrated. Yeah. They had a lot of things in our little town for youngsters, like we had a Christmas tree at Christmas, a huge Christmas tree put up by the Trinity, still works, of course. But we would go and carol there, whether you could sing or not, you caroled, and you got a box of candy. And they had clubs. They had a little mother's club. I joined the little mother's club, and I learned how to make beds and take care of babies, even though we had all these children at home.
Mm-hmm.
I still wanted to be a little mother down there. And from that, I went into the Girl Scouts, and I branched off and became a campfire girl. I think I was a campfire girl before I was a Girl Scout, yeah. So when I belonged to those three things and talked a lot about them at home, my father always said I was a joiner. I joined everything around. But, you know, they were just lots of fun. But that, and at the same time, we learned something. My one memory of the, or one big memory of the being in the public high school was that we had domestic science, which meant that you learned how to cook. And our teacher was a very, I think then I called her bigoted, although I'm not too sure, she was just bigoted. But I can still hear her say, the girls from the Holy Name School wouldn't understand this, but, and then she would explain something, see, because it seemed that in the eighth grade in the public school they had their beginning of their domestic science. And since we didn't have domestic science in our eighth grade, we weren't supposed to be as bright as these others, you know. And Ari remembered that she said that about us. Also, they had sewing classes. And my mother had taught me to run a sewing machine and to sew by hand, too. And I think I was just maybe 8 or 9 years old, hardly able to reach the pedals on the old Singer machine. But she taught me first on making diapers for the next baby we were having. She'd always tell me, we're going to have a new baby, and then I'd help her, you know, do this thing. And I suppose you don't know what a kimono is.
I think
a
so.
Little, you know, robe or some kind of a thing that they put on babies. Well, when I was a freshman, the war was going on. That was the First World War. And we started making little gray flannelette kimonos for the Belgian babies. I don't know why just the Belgian babies, but they did. But the teacher wouldn't let us do any work at all, either on a sewing machine or by hand, until we would first come and show her our basting. And she would check all the basting, how, you know, the quarter inch or half inch or whatever your seam was going to be, you know, or whatever. I used to get so sick and tired of waiting in line to have her inspect my work, you know, when I knew all about sewing, I thought, but I would have to do that. So the war ended that November, and I was in the public school, and I didn't have my little kimono made for that Belgian baby, and it's the first thing I cried about, that Belgian baby probably wouldn't get that kimono. You know, then the reality of the whole thing came to me when we had neighbors who lost sons who didn't come home. See, I didn't have any brothers in the war, of course, and no uncles either, so, you know, that made a difference to me.
Mm-hmm.
I could very cheerfully gather peach stones. It was one of the things that we had barrels all around town, and you would put peach stones in the barrels. I don't know what they did with the peach stones.
That was part of the war effort?
Yeah, the war effort. Mm-hmm. And victory bonds or, you know, so on. I remember, too, that the king and queen of, I don't know, it was of England or what country, I believe England, that came through town in a motorcade and, you know, standing on the sidewalk and seeing them, you know, drive past and, you know, the ermine, so I thought it was on their, you know, coats. Just thought that was just something to see all that royalty. And different big people in industry would come to Duquesne and inspect the steelworks because, you you know, we were really turning out some fine work there. You would get gold stars in your window. I think they were gold stars. Gold Star Mothers got something, but I think we got some kind of star for the bonds you bought and given to the Red Cross. You got stickers to put in your window, you know, stuff like that. In other words, if you didn't have anybody really fighting in the war, you sort of had a lot of excitement going on in your life anyhow, you know, because somebody else was telling you all about these things. And I remember so well that the our sister Marie Celine, who is now deceased, they lived in Duquesne, Daugherty's, and her sister Loretta, who is still living up in Somerset, was a nurse, and they were older. Marie Celine was the youngest, and then there was George and John, and Loretta. And at that time, Loretta was drafted. No, pardon me. John was drafted, supposed to go to the war. And you didn't say they went to the train or whatever, you went to war. And I could digress a bit there because I would go down to the station when they would leave. They'd leave from some little old station we had in town. And especially mothers of foreign, you know, Slavish or Polish, those mothers were especially, oh, it was so hard for them. They'd throw themselves on the ground and scream, you know, when their sons were leaving. But we'd always go down to see the soldiers off anyhow. And, well, come back to the Daugherty family. John was drafted. And he was the chief wage earner then because their father had died. So Loretta petitioned the, I don't recall the draft board or what, but she made it, gave a petition then that she would be sent instead because she wasn't able to earn enough as a nurse to take care of her family, but John was. So they took Loretta instead. Well, Loretta, I suppose, went overseas. I remember keeping track of her, and then she came back, and they asked her to speak at a war bond rally at the playground. They had a big platform, and, you know, all decorated, and all stand there, and I am just so, oh, you know, so thrilled to see Loretta up there in her uniform, and she's going to talk. And when she stood before her own townspeople, she couldn't talk. She broke down, cried and cried. So, you know, that went in me. I never forgot that picture of Loretta crying there. And I thought, you know, she was so brave to go to the war. And I suppose I pictured her overseas as being right there with the front line, you know, the trenches and so on. Because the fighting was done from trenches. You know, all our newsreels, you know, were, there were stills, but they were all, you know, showing these things. And I went down to Carnegie Library to hear a soldier who had come back. His my mother took me and my brother, and the name of the book, this man, his name was Arthur Guy Empey. I don't remember how to spell Empey, E-M-P-E-Y, I suppose. But he wrote, I think it would be the first big seller of the war. And he wrote Over There. It was the title of the book. And, it just sold, I suppose, you know, millions of copies. I didn't look at numbers of copies being sold then. I just knew that everybody was talking about Arthur Guy Empey, you know, and what he had written.
He was from Duquesne.
No, I don't know where he was from. But his lecture was given at Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh. And my mother took us in on the streetcar to hear it. Mm-hmm. So that was a little recollection of the war. The war was really a terrible experience. And around that time, too, we had the flu epidemic. But I'll stay with the war. We had enough to eat. There didn't seem to be the rationing that there was later on in World War II at all. We had, you know, enough to eat. And they were, of course, everybody had a little victory garden. We did that. Every little plot of land around, even your front yard where you had grass and rose bushes or whatever, you know, they dug up and planted tomatoes and radishes and onions and lettuce, stuff like that, you know, to help the war effort. But it was all just a glamorous thing, you know, when you were young, just really glamorous. And I remember when the armistice was signed, that the men from the mill broke out. See, that news would come in the papers or wireless, you know, there was no such thing as radio or TV. And when that news came through, the townspeople just became, oh, they just ran. They just ran through town. They came up and opened the school doors and demanded the school. Oh, they didn't demand. They just came in and took all the kids out. We all went out of school, left the classrooms, and the sisters and the teachers standing there looking for us, you know.
You were at Holy Name then?
Yes. By that time I'd gone into Holy Name. Oh, it was just, you know, so exciting that the war was over. And there was a false armistice first. I don't know what date that was. I don't remember now, but you could check on that. The false armistice, it really didn't, you know, the armistice was not, the war wasn't over. And then it was. And I remember I had my mother's brother, who was long past war age, had a very tragic death during that time, and that found its way in a little back section of the newspaper, because the whole, you know, front section in type, I guess 4 or 5 inches, you know, in depth,
sure,
was the war was over. Really great. Well, then the flu epidemic along there made great inroads on everything, killing out people. The first year, we did not get it in our family, but a lot of people, everybody around us was, you know, had somebody dying or whatnot. And I remember some of my very, you know, good friends, they would have people in their families die. And if you went to the drugstore with a prescription, you had to sit and wait for hours and hours to get your medicine filled. Also, along that time, I bossed all my brothers and sisters, whether they liked it or not. I read in the paper that if you took a tablespoon, you made it, first of all, you got a milk bottle. And, you know, they used bottles, glass bottles, and not the cartons they have now. And if you filled that with so much water, and then you took so much vinegar and so much red pepper and mixed that up and took a teaspoonful of that, I don't know how many times a day, that you wouldn't get the flu. Well, my poor little brothers and sisters had a line up, and I gave them that dose every day. But we didn't get the flu that year. They still remember that about me.
Yes.
So it really happened. And, you know, my mother just laughed. Some were my nonsense, and she didn't, you know, at least I wasn't killing them with pepper and vinegar and water. But I was sure we weren't going to get the flu. We didn't get it that year, but we got it the next year. And, of course, we had a lot of school. We closed the schools down that first year because it was so terrible. And then the second year, my mother was pregnant, and she had the flu, and the baby was born prematurely and also had the flu. And that baby died, I think it was 6 weeks old. But as long as it, well, the doctor told us right away that it wouldn't live, but as long as it lived 6 weeks, you know, we had hopes it would continue to live. And we called him Billy. So when he died, we wanted the funeral from our home. No one went to funeral parlors. There weren't any funeral parlors. But we wanted a casket and everything laid out, although the doctor, the undertaker, had said that it was common just to put the babies in a, you know, a little box and, you know, bury them in the cemetery. But we wouldn't have that, so we had this little white casket in the corner of the room and our parlor. And then if people used to put, what do they call these things, on the front porch, you'd hang it right beside your door. What were they? It wasn't a wreath. It was, a floral thing of some kind. I can't remember the name of that. But we had one of them on our door, so my friends would all know that we had our baby died. And all the kids came and, came in. Well, then we didn't have any kind of a hearse or any kind of a procession, you know. That kind of disappointed us, you know. The undertaker just came and took the baby in a little white casket and buried it. Billy.
How many children grew up in the family?
Seven of us grew up. We had one baby died after me. He was between me and my next brother. And he died at birth. My brother was so put out about this baby dying. He was maybe 2 years old. And he'd go up and down the street. He thought that the doctor brought a dead baby, and he'd go up and down the street saying, "Dr. Martin, bring us another baby, but don't bring us a dead one." And Keith happened, oh, it just broke my mother's heart. You know, they tell him not to do that again. They put soap in his mouth if he did, but he'd go up and, "Dr. Martin, bring us another baby, but don't bring us a dead one." So that was nine we would have had then. So seven of us lived through a number of years. Duquesne, when it became bigger, you know, then we no longer had our little, for a few years we had a little town paper, and we didn't have that. It didn't last many years anyway. But like people were, you know, moving away or moving out up to Catherine Street, you know, was really, you know, like I said, there was 7th Street and Arles and then Catherine, you know, and then just like little farmlands. But while we live up there now, you know, it's populated and all
would
that.
They build up, kept building.
Yes,
higher.
Building out, you know, like any town does. Because you couldn't build to, you could build one side, all right, because that was towards Kennywood. And they did build what they called Duquesne Place out that way. And that's still very, you know, flourishing place. But over the other direction, towards McKeesport, there was just no place to build. That was Dravosburg, if you went far enough along the hill. But people got them. They weren't buying in Duquesne. They were, you know, going to McKeesport or Pittsburgh. No one seemed to go to Homestead. Maybe they did, but, you know, to buy in Homestead, because you went through Homestead to go to Pittsburgh.
Was there a company store in Duquesne?
No, I never knew anything about company stores. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Carnegie, and I wondered, did you think of Carnegie as a man, or was that just a name?
No, we thought of him as a man, because he seemed to come through the works enough, you know, to that we'd known. I knew what he looked like.
You did?
Yes.
What were some of the things that he did in the town?
Well, besides the library, and maybe he was responsible for some of the playgrounds. They're very finely equipped, not just equipped, but good teachers, you know, people taking care of them. They also had, like the one below the railroad, had a swimming pool. And they had, also those fireworks were, you know, paid for by the Carnegie Steelworks. I think it was really after I left in 23 that it became the United States Steel. It was still Carnegie Steelworks up until that time. No, of course, the town got very dirty because of the steelworks and what they called a slip. I don't know what happened, but in the furnaces, they would have what we called a slip, and there'd be all this red, you know, there'd be white smoke and red smoke come up out of the furnace, and then it would blow, and usually blew towards town, you know, not over the river, but up towards us. Well, then everybody went out and tried to help the neighbors take down their washing if they had their washing up.
Did they get any warning it was coming?
No, you never knew when it was going to happen. And, you know, if you didn't have your own washing up, because nobody had washers or, you know, I mean, the dryers, we had a washer. But you didn't know when that was going to happen. And then your clothes would have all these little white or red specks on them. And your mother had to wash them over again. But the clothes then that were dried outside had the best smell, especially if they dried in the winter time. And that they were frozen, you know, when your mother took them down off the line. They always had a real nice smell. And in our street, we had an old lady a couple doors from us. I don't think she was our next door neighbor next to us. Her name was Mrs. Kelly. And she had her two grandchildren living with her, a girl and a boy. And she must have gotten up about 3 o'clock because she would love to have her clothes boiled, you know, a big boiler, and you'd boil the clothes in them and get them through. And then she just loved to have them out there before 5 o'clock, I think. And then if the weather was good, she'd sit out on her back door swing. You always had a swing on your back porch. She'd sit out there and just look at her clothes blowing, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning. And anybody that wasn't that active, you know, maybe they get theirs out at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock or whatever. But she wanted to be first getting hers out. And it was to get Mrs. Kelly. My mother never had hers out that early, I know. She was good to get them out at 7 o'clock. But that was just neighborhood rivalry. And there were no stores. Just poor people, we thought, bought an A&P. An A&P came to town. We thought anybody that was real poor had to go down to the A&P and buy their food.
Where did you buy your food?
Charmin's Grocery, corner grocery. So, and right across the street from Charmin's Grocery, one of their uncles, Nick Charmin, had a saloon. And I mean a saloon. It was not a cafe or anything else. It was a saloon with a three-cornered, you know, I mean not three-cornered, but on the corner, they had the door going, you know, across the corner. And there was a brass rail in there and swinging doors. And Eileen, Charmin, and I, we would get down outside the door and look under there to see what we could see. And all we could see was this brass railing and the men with their foot up on it, you know, drinking. And the smell of the beer was terrible. But, you know, we like to look anyhow until some men would start coming out or somebody coming in and they'd chase us. I remember Prohibition when they had to, you know, take all the liquor, whatever they had, and pour it out.
Did they actually have to pour that out?
Oh, yeah, into the street, into the gutter, and went down into the gutters. Yeah, we stood and watched, you know.
Did Carnegie provide anything for the parish, did you know?
Yes. They, Carnegie Steelworks, provided the electricity for all our lights in our church. I don't know about now, I doubt it. But our church and our school, and I guess the rectory and convent. Because when we built our school, I remember that some bigoted Protestants put across the First Street from Telegraph Pole, I guess to Telegraph Pole, a big banner, and it said, "We want free water for our swimming pool." We didn't have a swimming pool, but you know, we made a big thing out of that. We walked up and down the street. "We don't have a swimming pool. They're dumb. We don't have a swimming pool." You know, as if anybody cared about our big mouths going.
I wonder if that was just the custom, if every church was providing that.
I don't know. The one tragic thing about it was that whoever had something to do with it or how they did it, big events in our church, I know more than one, the lights would go out in the church. In fact, I was confirmed in the dark. You know, because we got candles and, you know, people throughout the church held candles, but it was at night. And even my father's a, you know, non-Catholic, he was there at my confirmation, and the whole thing was done in darkness.
Well, you mean the lights just went out during the ceremony?
Yes, the light was, the electricity failed, you know, and why it failed, I don't know. But there were bigoted people, you know, in town, a lot of them. I suppose, you know, I really had a fight for my religion. I don't think I was just a natural born fighter. I think I had to defend it. The whole town, though, when you knew everybody and you knew the old dirt roads and, you know, that kind of thing, and you all gathered for celebrations, I think it, you know, made for a good spirit. Even, you know, as I told you, just go along the street and you'd love to be with your father because he'd call across to everybody, you know. And it would take my mother forever to get home from going down the street to do any shopping because she'd stop on every street corner and talk to the neighbor or the person that she knew that would be passing by. You know, they'd stop on the street corner and talk for a while. And, you know, she'd finally get home. And my father'd say, "Where's your mother? She went down the street how many hours ago?" You know, she stops at every street corner. Well, he didn't stop, but he certainly, you know, called to everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just real friendly.
Do you remember any labor activity?
No, I don't know anything about strikes or difficulties of that kind at all.
Did your father ever voice anything regarding
No. Mm-mm. I think that they were underpaid probably, and as I said, there was no compensation for any accidents of any kind, but I never, you know, knew anything about unrest or anything like that among the mill men. And of course, when the Depression came on, it was, you know, very hard for everybody, no matter whether you were a steel worker or what. By that time, I was in the community. I really didn't know, you know, that they had as hard a time as they had, because my mother never let me know any difficulties. So, I don't know.
You made a remark about Sister Florence being out walking, and I wondered, was that customary for the sisters to be out walking and
yes.
visiting?
Yes. You know, there was no park or place. Well, that playground is no place to walk there. You know, there were no parks. There's a sort of a park there now. A war memorial was where the playground was. But there wasn't any place to walk except, and they were hills, you know. And they were, and I mean the hills when I say that. Really steep places. But Sister Florence often walked up our hill, because between our house and Priscilla Avenue, there was a vacant lot. And, you know, she'd stop or come over to our place sometimes for, you know, a cold drink.
No, I never thought that was unusual for the sisters visited in their house.
Oh, no. Uh-uh. No. If we had lemon, she got lemonade, and if we didn't, she got cold water. And you got your ice by putting a sign your window, there'd be 25 at one, because you didn't have a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You had an ice box. So, and you bought your meat and things like that for a couple of days, never, you know, for a long time at all.
You said to ask you about your Cleveland vacations.
Oh, well, my Cleveland vacations were, you know, just something, you know, I want to insert there because they were just so much fun. The other children had some later on, yes, but I got to go, I guess, almost every summer that my mother would put my brother and me Ed was next to me, except that we had the little baby die. But she put us on the train, put us in charge of the conductor, and sent us to Cleveland. And the only thing I have against it was that my brother sang. And, you know, people in the train would, the coach, you know, would come along and stop and speak to him, you know, and talk to him, make a fuss over us. And I just wanted to be proper and be riding in a train. I didn't want people talking to us. So I used to fuss about that. But when we got to Cleveland, we had a lot of fun. My grandparents were good people, and I always saw, and so did my father's sister. They were not Catholics, of course, but she always had a Catholic neighbor take us to Mass. And we'd go to parks, and also to Euclid Beach on Lake Erie. And we had a lot of fun like that. I really liked that. And I remember taking